And this is Execution Watch on radio station KPFT HD2 channel. Tonight is January the 14th, 2009, a Wednesday at 6 o'clock Central Time in Houston, your HD radio on KPFT HD2 channel or on the Internet. You can hear it at www.executionwatch.org. There are links to that link off of kpft.org and theprisonshow.org. I am Ray Hill, and tonight we have the execution, scheduled execution of Curtis Moore. And as far as we know from this studio at this time, that is proceeding. Curtis Moore is 40-year-old, scheduled to die tonight for a murder that happened 12 years ago, the abduction murder of Henry Truvillan in Fort Worth during a 1995 drug deal turned robbery. Moore had been in and out of the state of custody since he was age 12. His attorney had petitioned the state unsuccessfully to reopen the case based on evidence that he is mentally ill and mentally retarded. With me tonight is legal analyst Jim Skelton. Jim has been a practicing lawyer. Generally he spends his time talking to others. But Dennis Longmire is joining us right now. Have you got him on the microphone? I'm not getting him in my ears. Dennis?
Yes, sir. Guantanamo
Can you hear me?
After being captured in Pakistan at the age of 14.
This is Ray. We've got to get you on the air. We've got you on the telephone, but not the air. Push where it says phone.
New York-based organization Human Rights Watch has called on the incoming American president.
And for some reason, try that at the top. Do something up there.
It said Mr. Obama should place human rights at the heart of his foreign.
We're not getting you on, Dennis.
In its annual
I'm sorry, we have a technical problem. What's going on there?
Well, the witnesses for both the media and the witnesses for Curtis Moore have already entered the Walls unit. There were four witnesses who went in on behalf of Curtis. I was not able to identify any of them. But they did enter the building probably 3 minutes or so ago, and the media had gone into the building just a minute or so prior to that. So, unfortunately, it appears that everything is going to be going on as scheduled, and my guess is that in about 19 or 20 minutes we'll see them coming back out.
Are you alone out there?
No, there are actually four of us. I'm here with three other members of the vigil. I hesitate to call us protesters.
It's
not a protest. It's a witnessing. We're witnessing the injustice that's about ready to take place.
Well, we will, you know, you have Elizabeth's cell phone number, so if something else happens, get in touch with her, and we'll be talking to you later in the show.
And if you get your technical difficulties
cleared up, it is now resolved, and we'll get right back to you.
Okay.
Thank you, Dennis.
Sure.
And that's Dennis Longmire, who is standing vigil in Huntsville, Texas. With me in the studio is Jim Skelton. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, as you said earlier, this guy has been in and out of the system since he's been age 12. Mm-hmm. And what led to the death penalty, he and his nephew, he was at the time, and is very close to 40 when all this, I'm not close to 40, but he was at 40 at the time of the offense. As a matter of fact, he'd be his own parole. And he and his 17-year-old nephew get together, three guys outside the edge of Fort Worth, to do a drug deal. And what happened, they go over to Curtis Moore's sister's house to do this drug transaction, apparently going to buy or sell cocaine. So the three guys are in there discussing the cocaine deal, and Curtis and his nephew go in the bathroom and come running out and hollering, "This is a jack, this is a jack." They'd robbed the three men. He takes $150 from one and $50 from another, around $200.
$200.
Then, for a reason known only to Curtis Moore, he takes the three men, two of them, holds a gun on them, and he gets his nephew to tie them up. And he puts two of the men in the trunk of the car and takes another one of the men, another male, and puts him in the front car with him, and they drive off with this guy's car. end up at the man's house and get his girlfriend out. He ends up tying up the girlfriend plus the other person that had been a part of the drug transaction, shoots and kills both of them, kills a man and a woman after he ties them up. He still got these two people tied up in the trunk of the car. And he opens up the trunk and shoots both of them. Shoots one in the leg and shoots one in the stomach or chest. Then he slams the lid down and kind of like, I guess it was like an afterthought, at least this came from the testimony of the one person that survived. He then goes back and opens the trunk and douses both bodies with gasoline, gets his lighter and sets them on fire and tries to throw the lid down again. So now there have been, and the two gentlemen in the trunk of the car kicked, one of them kicked the trunk open, drug the other, fell out, and they took off running. And Curtis Moore began to chase them. One guy gets on the ground, the one ended up dying and rolled in the dirt to kind of get the plane stopped, and the one survivor got out to some woods and played like he was dead, and Curtis Moore walked off and left him. That's the only reason he survived. The other gentleman who had been set on fire and shot died. So they end up a total of three people being killed in this. So the ones, of course, the person that survived when the car, when the fire trucks come out to take care of the car being on fire, he reported to the fire people. And it took him like almost a week or 2 weeks in the hospital before he could even talk to anybody about it. He was so messed up. He was burned over 60 to 70% of his body, plus he's shot in the leg on top of that. And he was the one that was a major witness against Curtis Moore during the trial, and they tried him for the capital murder of all three people because... What happened, after they arrested Curtis Moore and his nephew, the nephew took the police back to the 9mm gun that was used to do the killing of the two earlier individuals. So he ended up killing three people during a drug transaction and setting two of them on fire and shooting two of them. And he was on parole at the time, and... As you said earlier, it's just one of those deals where he's been in and out of the system. In fact, the system has handled him since he's been 13 years of age. He went to a boys' school when he was 13. He went to reform school. He ended up going to prison. It's kind of that old litany you hear over and over again. He's kind of a product of our system. And what really has delayed most of this, during the time, I think when he's 12 years old, his IQ was tested at 68 or somewhere around 70. And that's what they've been attempting to use as a means to keep him being executed. But this having a low IQ by itself is not going to be sufficient because we've got a case called Brasino where you've got to not only have to have a low IQ, you've got to have lack of adaptive behavior. And here's the big flip, and here's the thing that really gets lawyers in trouble. The lawyer that defended him was aware of the fact that when he was 12 years old, he had this real low IQ. And one of the things he thought about doing was bringing this up during the trial. But when you do that, this means you have to let the state psychiatrist also examine your client. And what happens, you have no control over that, because then that psychiatrist can come back on the supposedly doing an exam to CIQ and can come back later and claim the guy's a sociopath, he's a future threat. And you don't want that sort of testimony coming in front of a jury. So the trial lawyer had a real dilemma because he could also have argued about the guy having a low IQ, but he couldn't do that since he'd had to let the state experts also examine him. And in doing that, you can't limit that examination. In doing that, it opened up the door for the state to be able to get evidence that he'd be a future danger, that he could testify and hurt him bad at a punishment hearing. So he and Curtis Moore talked about it, and Moore did not want to be examined by a psychiatrist. He didn't want to have that little sit-down where he would have to go into his whole background. So what happened, that was one of the major issues on appeal, is whether or not his lawyer was ineffective. But I'm sympathetic with a lawyer because you also open up a big Pandora's box sometimes.
Yeah.
By permitting a state psychiatrist to come in and examine your client because that can come back and bite you in the bottom. And so that was a big issue on appeal. And the problem is, he just, under our definition of what it takes to keep somebody from being executed, there was never any evidence in the federal circuit decisions or the state decisions that he lacked adaptive behavior. For example, case here recently, one of the things to look at, a guy can make a Whataburger. You know, maybe dumb as a stump, but if he make a Whataburger, he's got adaptive behavior and said he wasn't retarded. And they talk a lot about what sort of adaptive behavior, whether or not the crime that he committed required some planning. It's evidence that he wasn't retarded.
It wasn't a lot of quality planning, apparently, but
well,
some planning.
A lot of anger.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. It was one of those where you kill, like, say, three. And what's interesting about it, they had a case almost as bad here recently in Dallas County, and they didn't even seek the death penalty on. That's how much things have changed since then.
Well, this is Tarrant County. And,
yeah, but just the difference in the era of time. Yeah. They just had to recently had a case that they affirmed on appeal. Where people go in, the same sort of deal, kill three people in a drug transaction, but no death penalty solved.
Well, so they never even approached the mental retardation, mental illness angle at all. That was never an issue in this case.
Not at the trial level. Because at the trial level...
Well, if it's not at the trial level, it's not on appeals.
Well, at the appellate level, while they try to approach it, it seemed the lawyer was ineffective for not bringing this to evidence available. Because remember, when you have a writ hearing, you can go back, and what most writs are based upon what the lawyer didn't do as opposed to what he did. So at a writ hearing, they could develop mental retardation. They said, you know, you have this evidence available, you could have developed, you simply failed to do so. But the reason the lawyer said he was aware of it, the reason the lawyer didn't do it, he didn't want a state psychiatrist examining his client for fear that he'd come back at a punishment hearing and say it'd be a future danger. You know, it's developed.
So it's a catch 22.
Exactly.
I mean, right. What you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Exactly. It's one of those decisions that you make. And he discussed it with Curtis Moore. I mean, this is not something that was.
Not something that was considered.
And he considered it, but he was afraid to have him examined. In fact, Curtis Moore himself did not want to be examined by a psychiatrist to have his IQ tested and go through a psychiatric exam. So it was one of those, like you say, it's a Hobson's choice. All the decisions were bad.
Well, this case was tried some, 12 years ago?
It was tried in 1995.
1995, so that'd be 13 years ago.
Right.
They're recently established mental health courts.
You know, Ray, this is, and we ought to, this is one of the more embarrassing things about our system. Because, you know, when you see a crime like this, you know, normally you think of somebody when they set a body on fire and mutilate a body after they kill somebody. That's normally what they call a crime of passion. It's usually where a wife or a husband has a lot of anger toward the person they're killing. And when somebody does something like this to apparently, and they there was no indication that Curtis Moore had any type of relationship with the people he killed, and the fact they were doing a drug deal together.
Yeah.
And what this tells most...
Well, actually, the people that he initially killed, the two women,
Well, one was not involved. What had happened, he kidnapped three men, took one man back to his house, and killed him and his girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
Then he killed the other two. And when you have a crime like that, what you normally think of is somebody's got a whole bunch of anger. Because to shoot somebody, open up a trunk and shoot somebody, then go back and set them on fire with gasoline and throw a lighter on them, that seems
pretty extreme.
Like you're really angry about something. And the only thing I can think of, I'm not saying mental health courts would have cured that. Here's what they're currently doing. We're kind of at least kind of smarting up. This started pretty much in Indianapolis, Indiana. Chicago has been one of the major cities that have done it. What they started doing is setting up mental health courts, what they call mental health courts. And the way that works, if there's somebody that comes in the system, and what they do in Chicago especially, they have a real good staff at the jail that interview people at intake. When they think somebody's mentally retarded or mentally ill, that's getting in trouble. Like Curtis in this particular case, he was a 12-year-old kid when he first started getting, a 13-year-old kid when he first started getting in trouble. What they do is send him to a mental health court. And they're more understanding. They have more things available. They have probation officers that are equipped. They do a lot more special work with these folks. They don't treat them like they do a regular crook. What they're trying to do is get them out of the system. Because you take a situation like this, Curtis Moore, and also he came from a large family. He was abused as a child. And, you know, when you're born, you're given a certain IQ. You don't earn that. You didn't ask to be born stupid. No one asked to be born that way, except maybe Republicans. But he didn't ask.
Well, I think a lot of that's developmental, too.
Well, that could be, too. You're given more credit than I am. But nonetheless, no one wants to be born stupid. And no one wants to be born with parents who beat the hell out of you in a large family. And this has been an age-old problem. What do you do with a youngster who's not very bright anyway, and you treat him like a mad dog? What do you get when you get finished? You get a mad dog that you turn loose on society that kills other people and sets them on fire with matches. And I'm not saying that a mental health court would have cured this, but had he been treated perhaps with more understanding when he was growing up and people equipped to do this. For example, there's a lot of controversy in Harris County. We've got a mental health court here in town, and some we've had some of these redneck judges, guys like Mike Anderson, who are more redneck than judge. He calls it a hug-a-thug group because they're very lenient to these folks. And what they try to do with people's mental illness is realize they're more apt to get in trouble. They need more than someone just yelling at them. They need some help. They need medication. They need professional help. They need some sort of professional care. And what they're attempting to do in Harris County is intercede when someone comes into jail if they got a mental health problem, or they may be retarded, to put them in a mental health court where they have specialists that are trained to help these folks kind of get stay out of the system and not be treated like I'm sure Curtis Moore was probably treated when he was a kid growing up.
Well, there's a lot of those people.
Right.
There's a lot of mental health issues. Does the mental health filter down to misdemeanor courts, or is it only for felony?
Thus far, it's only been in the felony courts. This is something brand new in Houston. In fact, Mark Ellis, one of the district court judges here in town, just got back from Chicago. He spent about a month up there. Chicago's been very, very forward-thinking in the way they've handled people with mental illness. And they're trying to divert them out of the system and trying to make them less dangerous, because when you start getting somebody who's got a mental illness and start treating like you would a regular convict, like you know how they're treated, that doesn't solve anything.
It doesn't help the mental illness part at all, sure.
A good example, these poor guys that got killed probably paid the price for what other people had done earlier to Curtis Moore. I'm not saying Curtis Moore would not have done this crime. All I'm saying is that had he been diverted to a mental health court, had he been treated differently, there's a greater probability they'd be alive today than not.
And the system is just now realizing this.
Yeah, what they did, they had, up until this last big flip-over election, we had three judges here in Harris County that they sent all the mental health cases to. One of them was Mark Carter, one was Mark Ellis, one was Caprice Cosper. And what they did, those were the three district court judges that had kind of a staff set up and trained to handle mental health people. And they had more probation officers. They had more support personnel to take care of them. And what they did at the first of the year when they had kind of the clean sweep, a lot of judges got defeated. Unfortunately, Caprice Cosper, a real decent person, got defeated. Jan Crocker is now the designated district court where all the mental health cases work. And the way that's supposed to work, if a lawyer or a prosecutor or a judge or somebody in the system has a case in their court where they think the person's retarded or they have a mental illness, they're to transfer that case to Jan Crocker's court. And Jan Crocker's court's a designated court that handles a cult of mental health court. And we did this with DWI cases. We did it with drug courts. We've done it with different courts.
Yeah, there have been specialized courts before.
And what's sad about it is, prevalent as mental illness is in our system, there are only about 150 courts nationwide that are mental health courts, and that's almost a shame.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think that a lot more of them be equipped to do that, because this is a classic example. Because Curtis Moore is one of those people that our system raised. He started out 13 years old, going to a boys' school. He graduated from boys' school to reform school. He graduated from reform school from TYC to the Texas Department of Corrections, made a couple of trips there, was on parole when he committed these murders. And literally, he's a product.
Oh, there are hundreds of those
people. Of course.
There are hundreds of people that do that type. And because it hasn't filtered down to misdemeanor courts, there's a lot of business in misdemeanor courts. You know, you can get acclimated to jail and prison through a misdemeanor offense.
Sure.
If you're out here, you don't have good walking around sense, you do something stupid, you walk hinky, act hinky, cop sees you, throws your ass in jail, you adapt to that way of life, wait a minute, you know, this is better than living out of garbage cans and all of that, and so you keep returning to it, and you're just smart enough to know how to screw up on a regular basis, and so you got a population problem if you don't address those cases from a mental health standpoint.
And you know as well as I do, once you get, and of course the old phrase they talk about is, be being institutionalized, once you get used to that system, it's almost a sense of security for
you. It becomes your mother.
It's right. And after a while, that becomes your way of life. And what they're attempting to do with these mental health courts is through education, through vocational training, they're working with different agencies here in town that do mental health work, and they're working with these various agencies here in town and trying to get them help occupation-wise, trying to get them education-wise, getting their family set up, getting them apartments set up, will I have a place to live? Like, it's almost criminal that we have a building that used to be our jail on Franklin Street that's, what, 10 or 15, 10 stories high? It's empty. And four blocks away, people are sleeping on the street. Now, that is stupid because you got that huge empty jail that's got rooms in it and beds, and yet people four blocks away, by those rescue missions, down by the ball stadium, are sleeping on the street. And most of those people are mentally ill. They're not there because they chose to be there. They're mentally ill people.
But if you put them in that cage and you don't have the right kind of personnel to supervise them and to come up with some kind of estimation of what their needs are, you're not helping the problem.
Not doing a thing in the world, but creating a bigger problem. And then, like I say, I'm really excited about these courts because I think that we're finally getting some... They're addressing a problem rather than coming back later and punishing people for problems they really had no control over. Because the truth of the matter is, I'm reminded again, I've said this numerous times before, I remember reading a book about Sonny Liston, and it started off saying he died the day he was born. But someone like Curtis Moore, who is born, who's slow at birth, and he's in a large family, to a family that's very abusive, what chances does he have? And what and then you start out, our system could have done something about it because they first contacted him when he was 13 years of age. He didn't commit these murders till his 40s. So we've handled him from age of 13 up until he killed three people. And our state agencies handled
him. Jim, there are hundreds of people.
I know.
I know. When you're in prison, you can sit there and you can look around. You can see who has got walking around sense, who doesn't have walking around sense. And guess who keeps coming back? Keeps coming back people that are more heavily abused under that system than the people who that you know prosper in that environment, and because once you adapt to prison life, and I don't care how rudimentary the reasoning, once you adapt to it, you are damn sure ill adapted to live out here.
See, the toxic stew is that plus not being very bright. Because at least a lot of people who get in trouble, at least if they're bright enough to realize, after a while they'll have realize that what they're doing is wrong. But if you're a little slow to begin with, and this happens to you, it's just a toxic mix that you never overcome.
Well, how do you sort out those who know what's right and wrong from those who don't have anywhere else to go but back into an environment to which they've adapted?
I don't think you should sort them out. I don't think the idea is whether you know right from wrong. I think the whole idea should be, how do you make people less dangerous and how do you make society safer? And the way you make society safer is you can't... For example, if I was a doctor and somebody came in with measles, I wouldn't treat everybody the same because people's physiologically are different. A person with a fever should not be everybody given the same medication.
No.
And by the same token, our system's going to have to realize that a lot of people who break the law are not inherently bad. They're reacting to things that they have no control over, either through mental illnesses or through lack of adaptive behavior after something horrible has happened to them. We've got to address those problems. We can't just treat everybody identically. It'd be the same thing. Medicine would be messed up if everybody with a fever got the same pill.
Okay.
And a fever can be symptoms of many things, and we've got to start learning to do that. Mental health courts at least is a step that direction.
And you're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. Elizabeth's trying to get Dennis Longmire on the phone, and I'm talking to Jim Skelton, and we're analyzing the issues involved in the case of Curtis Moore. Curtis Moore apparently had some adjustment problems, some psychological, some retardation problems that were never examined in his trial. And that's what we've been talking about. But Dennis Longmire is back on the phone. Professor.
Yes.
what's happening in Huntsville?
Well, things in Huntsville are terrible as usual. The witnesses, both the media and the witnesses for Curtis, have come back out of the walls unit, which means for those of us down in the corner, we know that the execution has taken place. We know that Curtis is now no longer with us, and so we're not happy, but it is over.
Well, I think that we've all appreciated this short sabbatical we've had during the holidays, and now the business is cranking up to be business as usual.
I was going to say absolutely. The short stop is better than no stop at all. Unfortunately, we have quite a number on schedule for this month. And, of course, I'm sure there will be more people added to the ultimate list as the days go on. So I think this is going to be a long year for us here in Huntsville.
Who we're talking to here on Execution Watch, I'm Ray Hill, and we're talking to Dennis Longmire. Dennis is a professor of criminal justice at Sam Houston State University. What exactly it is you teach, Professor?
I teach, this semester I'm teaching a class in ethics, an undergraduate class, and then two program evaluation classes for a Master's of Science degree program we have. I generally teach graduate level classes in the area of criminological theory and ethical issues.
Well, business is very good at Sam Houston. The university is growing in bounds. Every time I go up there are cranes in the air. They're building new buildings, expanding. The humanities department is something going on right now.
Yes, the university is thriving. Unfortunately, so too is the prison thriving. And
yes.
As you know, Huntsville, Texas kind of lives off of the state, both the university and the prison system. And so in many ways, we're feeling very good in spite of the rest of the nation and generally part of the state who are suffering economically.
Yeah, well, whenever I was a young undergraduate, they said there were two hills in Huntsville. If you didn't go to one, you're liable to have to go to the other one.
That's generally the truth. Well, unfortunately, if we could get more of them into the university and fewer of them into the prisons, we'd have a much better place to live.
Well, Professor Longmire, looks like we've got a few days off. I think our next scheduled execution's on the 21st. We'll be talking to you then.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis, for standing by. That's Professor Dennis Longmire, whose profession is to look after the criminal justice system and try to improve it. And Jim and I have been talking a little bit about that, about a new development of mental health courts, which is new to this area, but apparently has been going on in other areas for some time in Illinois.
Right. Chicago's been doing this, the Midwest. Chicago started this about 10 years ago. They're light years ahead of what we're doing here in Harris County.
Mm-hmm.
And our big problem here is trying to get some of our redneck judges to understand what's going on. And, you know, I was thinking if we're going to have a $9 billion shortfall in our budget and most of the money's going to prison systems, then we better start learning to do something to keep people out of prison or we're going to go broke.
Well, the cost of operating prison has escalated considerably. Right now we're talking about more than $30,000 a head just to keep them in prison. And, of course, listeners say, oh, my God, look at all those luxuries. Well, actually, that's what security costs. All of this homeland security stuff and all this expanding in the security world has made competition for skills available for prisons to increase in price.
What's interesting, Ray, they had they're $9 billion short in their budget, and I just noticed in the paper TDC is wanting $1 billion and something more this year on their budget. So their prices are going up, and our budget's going down.
Dave Atwood is joining us. Dave?
Hi, Ray.
Where are you and what's going on?
Well, at the corner of Westheimer and Shepherd, out in front of St. Anne's Church, and it's a great place to have an execution protest. And didn't have a big crowd. We have six people out there tonight. But
will you beat Dennis Longmire and the crowd in Huntsville? They had four.
Okay.
So if there's competition among the vigil keepers, you're ahead by 2 points at this point.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's, I think a lot of people It's easy to get discouraged doing this because it just seems like the executions keep on going. And but, you know, we've been doing it for many years, so we're not giving up. We think at some point it's going to come to an end.
Well, Dave, you are well motivated enough to have written a book, and your involvement has been consistent and loyal. What keeps you going?
Well, I think the thing that really keeps me going, Ray, more than anything else, is the people on death row who I have visited over the years. I've seen them. I meet them. I meet their families. I know their. No matter what they did, this is not the right answer for them. And I have actually, like I've said before, I've been to 3 executions. I've seen it right there before my eyes. I've seen how what I consider just to be a very evil thing. And but if the guys on death row and their families, this is just a horrific thing for them, no matter what they've done in the past. And, of course, we know that many of them do change and they're not the same person that committed a crime many years ago.
No, we never execute the person that did it. It's somebody
who... So that's the primary thing that keeps me going, Ray, are the people that I've met and known and friends that I've had executed over the years. And it's just something so horrible for our society that we just have to stop it at some point. And you know, we find, what I think I've said this before, but when we were out there on the street corner, we get the vast majority of the people, if they do anything, it's a thumbs up to what we're doing. And so that it didn't used to be that way years ago, but I think it does have an impact. You know, one guy in a fancy sports car stopped and looked over me and smiled, and I thought he was going to say something nasty, but he said, "Thank you for being out here. I really appreciate it." So you get those nice comments every now and then, which really helps.
Do you perceive any shift in the attitude?
Yes, among citizens, definitely. Among citizens. I think we're dealing right now with politicians and officials that keep this thing going. And I've racked my brains about what we could do to actually, because it seems like the number, the number of death sentences given out by juries has dropped dramatically. But we don't have ourselves, the activists, certainly don't have any control over this procedure, the execution, setting execution dates. And that, I've racked my brains on how to do something more effective there. And I can't really, you know, to me, the death penalty is clearly unconstitutional, just under the rhetoric of being arbitrary and capricious when they stopped it back in the 70s. It was on that basis. And it's still, if you look at how it's carried out and all the problems with it, it's still arbitrary and capricious. But I've told a number of attorneys, I said, you know, why can't we take a case to the Supreme Court that just forces them to look at the constitutionality? And it just seems like if they gave it a fair hearing, they'd have to declare the death penalty unconstitutional. But the attorneys don't think that they've got the stroke to do that yet, particularly maybe with this Supreme Court. And but I can't see, you know, we've got 14 scheduled, well, I guess after today, 13, just in the first 3 or 4 months here. And I don't know how to stop it. It's just very frustrating.
Dave, what's the name of the book?
The book is Detour to Death Row, and people can get it on Amazon.com. It talks about the history of the death penalty going back from when I got started back in the early 90s and talks about the people on death row. It talks about murder victims who are, the families are against the death penalty, and it talks a lot about the criminal justice system. And, Ray, I'm going to get you a copy of that book. I'll bring one down to you.
Okay, Dave, what is the website for the coalition?
It's TCADP.org. CCADP.org.
As in the Coalition Against the Death Penalty, or Texas right. Coalition Against Death Penalty.
Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty, right.
.org. Thank you very much, Dave. And we have heard from Huntsville that the procedure has passed.
Okay. Well, another sad moment. Texas history. Thanks for what you're doing, Ray.
Thanks for what you do, Dave, and we'll be talking to you later.
Right. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Dave Atwood with the Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty, keeping a vigil at St. Anne's Church tonight out Westheimer and Shepherd. Sometimes they're at a Methodist church on the corner of Benz and South Main. Maybe got a little wind shelter over there. It's going to get colder tonight, I understand. What's going on now in Huntsville is that the family of the guy that was executed is awaiting the shipment of his body to the funeral home, where they'll get to see it one more time. It may be released to them to be buried somewhere else. That's not usually the case. Most people get sent to the indigent inmate cemetery, which is the Captain J. Byrd Cemetery, and that's in Huntsville, where he'll get a simple marker with not his name on it, but his TDCJ number on it. And following his number will be the letter X, because he was executed. One of my friends from death row died there but was not executed there. Was Carl Napier. So he's got his number up with no X, and after he speaks, before he died, he thought that that was a real success, that they would have to write a lot of footnotes about how to explain what happened to him on Texas death row. We're being joined now by Brian McCann, and Brian McCann is with the campaign to end the death penalty. And Brian?
Yes.
And you're active in Austin, is that true?
Correct.
And what do you do there?
Well, the Campaign to End the Death Penalty is we're a national organization with chapters all over the country. The Austin chapter, as you might imagine, we have our work cut out for us, and we have a number of individual cases we organize around, mainly cases like that of Rodney Reed, a death row inmate out of Bastrop, and also the high-profile yogurt shop case right here in Austin. In addition to that, we also work with other anti-death penalty organizations in organizing an annual march to stop executions, as well as other public events like film screenings, public panels, legislative-related events when that's appropriate. So we're active in a number of regards, but I would say largely we focus on organizing around cases and really emphasizing the family members of those on death row and putting their experiences on the forefront and giving them a voice in this movement.
Well, have you got any measurement on what level of impact or success you're having with your efforts?
I'm finding myself optimistic. Even though we're in Texas, you know, the state that executes the most than any in the country, I think we in our own way are following what has been a national trend against the death penalty. Nationally, the numbers of death sentences and executions continue to go down. And public support for the death penalty continues to decrease across the board in the country. And several states are beginning to consider abolishing the death penalty outright. New Jersey, in particular, recently abolished capital punishment. As far as our own effectiveness, we've seen a number of signs of hope. Probably the most pronounced one was last summer, summer of 2007. I guess that would be two summers ago. In which we organized a large grassroots campaign around the case of Kenneth Foster Jr., a man who was sentenced to death under the law of parties, which basically can sentence you to death for the murder someone else committed if you were physically present. But Kenneth, you know, we didn't believe he should be on death row, and we worked hard with his family throughout the summer of 07 and managed to win. Rick Perry commuted his sentence.
And that was rare for Rick Perry. He hadn't commuted many sentences.
Excuse me?
Rick hasn't commuted many sentences.
He has not, actually. This was the first time that Perry commuted a sentence under circumstances that were purely political, the first time he responded to a campaign and external pressure in such a way. While there had been some commutations while he's been governor, they've been largely the product of, you know, agreements between prosecution, defense, and for very kind of obscure legal reasons. But this was a situation in which, you know, we succeeded in building the political climate around the case, and Perry was really left with no other choice. He and the Board of Pardons and Paroles were, most people agree, just against the wall where Kenneth's case was concerned. So our ability to do that, I think, shows signs that we're making some progress. Also, the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas is increasingly on the defensive on both a national and domestic level.
Not a very friendly bunch.
Oh, yes, yeah, they are. They're a good crowd. They're a tough group, but especially Sharon Keller has shown her true colors in more than
one
case.
You mean 5 o'clock Keller?
Excuse me?
5 o'clock Keller?
Killer Keller?
5 o'clock.
5 o'clock Keller, yes.
She closes the office.
Yeah, that was really when I think the nation got a sense of what we deal with in Texas when she refused to keep the CCA open just a few more minutes for Michael Richard to get his appeal in.
And had he done that, he would have unquestionably received a stay.
Correct, because, yeah, that was the national trend, because the Supreme Court was preparing to hear the lethal injection case.
What should we know about the Rodney Reed case?
Rodney's case, in a lot of ways, is kind of prototypical of just about everything that's wrong with the death penalty. He's been on death row since 1998. He was sentenced to death for the murder of Stacy Stites, a young woman from Giddings, Texas. Rodney is from Bastrop. But Stacy was found dead on the side of a dust kind of country road. She had been strangled, and the prosecution argued that she had been raped. And there was a semen DNA sample found that matched Rodney, but Rodney and Stacy were having a well-corroborated affair at the time. The problem was that very few of those who get to testify to that relationship were called to testify at the original trial, both due to defense incompetence. He had court-appointed attorneys who really did not do the job he deserved in that original trial, but also there was a pretty pronounced environment of intimidation around the case, and that hinges largely on the fact that Stacy was engaged at the time she was killed to a white police officer named Jimmy Fennell, who a lot of Texans know about now because, as a Georgetown police officer, he's been sentenced to 10 years in prison for abducting and sexually assaulting a woman who was in his custody, though he pled down to improper sexual conduct, misconduct. There was the original charge was sexual assault. But most of the evidence in the case points to Fennell. The only fingerprints found in the truck that Stacy was driving the morning she was killed were his and Stacy's, and as soon as he got the truck back from authorities, he sold it right away. And he failed two lie detector tests. Subsequent girlfriends after the case, the girlfriend he had right after Stacy was murdered about 3 months after, testified that after they broke up, he stalked her. He was incredibly racist and, you know, really fit the profile of what Rodney's lawyers have been trying to put out about Jimmy, but and also the other DNA found at the scene of the crime on a beer can, a fresh beer can, matched one of Jimmy's close friends, another police officer. So between the prosecution suppressing witnesses, the defense not really doing their job, and this kind of web of police misconduct and corruption, as well as that kind of age-old taboo of black men and white women in the South, you know, in a lot of ways, Rodney's case speaks to everything that's wrong with the death penalty.
It's a Bastrop County case?
We got some new news from the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Is it a Bastrop County case?
A Bastrop County case, yeah. But yeah, the CCA just declared that they will not be granting Rodney a new trial. So that puts things most likely up to the federal courts again. So we still have some work to do, but we're continuing to work with the Reeds to continue bringing visibility to the Rodney case.
And what need we know about the yogurt shop cases?
Well, the yogurt shop case is an Austin-based case. There was in 1991, a really gruesome murder.
Famous case.
Yeah. 4 young girls really brutally murdered in a yogurt shop that was then set afire. And understandably, there was a great degree of public outcry around the case. And subsequently, a fair amount of political pressure on the Austin Police Department to find, arrest, and convict someone for the crime. Well, it took them 8 years and about 50 false confessions to settle on two guys, Michael Scott and Robert Springsteen. And they charged them with the murders and managed to convict them. Robert was originally sentenced to death, though they were under 18 at the time of the murder, so his sentence ended up getting commuted after the Supreme Court ruled juvenile executions unconstitutional. And then Mike, largely because our campaign works very closely with Janine Scott, his spouse, we rebuilt a campaign around his case during the original trial, and Janine herself will credit that with avoiding a death sentence. Mike got sentenced to life in prison. The thing about the case, though, is the only evidence linking these two guys to the crime is exactly the same thing 50 other people produced, which were confessions. And we actually have on camera an Austin detective holding a gun to Mike's head during the interrogations. So there's ample evidence that these confessions, like so many other confessions in false convictions, were coerced and manipulated. But fortunately, last year, the Court of Criminal Appeals threw out the original conviction because the prosecution had unconstitutionally used the two men's testimonies against each other. So they read Robert's testimony at Mike's trial without having Robert present, or his confession at the trial without having Robert present at Mike's trial, which is unconstitutional. You need to be able to confront your accuser. So they are actually headed into their new trial. They've had some pre-trial hearings that we've made a point of attending and having tickets outside of. But you know, we've been noticing a very palpable shift in attitudes around these two guys' case. Media and a number of other outlets really seem to be harboring some deep doubts. And both defense and prosecution have been performing more and more DNA tests on evidence at the original scene of the crime, and consistently all DNA tests have excluded Mike and Robert and exonerated them. So really all the state's got going for them is two coerced confessions and
Something like the other coerced confessions they have in this case, huh?
Excuse me?
There were other coerced confessions in this case.
Yes. Well, there are other false ones, and I believe, yeah, other coerced ones, too. But the two guys they ended up convicting were Mike and Robert.
Well, thank you for doing marvelous work over there. How do people get in touch with your organization?
Well, we have a number of outlets. You can either email me directly, or you can actually email our main Gmail account, cedpaustin@gmail.com.
Again, please?
cedpaustin@gmail.com.
Do you have a website?
We do. We have a MySpace page. It is www.myspace.com/cedpaustin. That's myspace.com/CEDP Austin.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us, Brian.
Pleasure.
Keep up your good work, and we will talk to you as, unfortunately, this process continues on and on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. We have one tonight, and, we've got to
work. The one tonight is over.
It is over? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. And that was Brian McCann of the... NoDeathPenalty.org is another web page that he gives. He's in Austin, Texas, and if you're interested in the group, you can call or email their organization. Jim,
yes.
It's been a mixed bag tonight. Several cases.
One thing I want to mention, and I know people are zealous in being against the death penalty, but you've got to be honest about it. And it simply is not true that this idea you can be convicted of the law party simply by solely being present. That's crazy. That's never been the law, is not the law, and it never has been the law. In order to be convicted as a law party, you've got to do something to aid, encourage, or assist somebody to commit a crime. And the law is real clear. Mere presence alone is insufficient. And people make statements saying you can be convicted for merely being present. That simply is not true. For example, if you're against the law of parties, then turning Charlie Manson free. Charlie Manson was convicted of the law of parties.
He was not even
prison. Never went to the house.
Right.
But what did he do? He was the one that set the ball in motion. He's the one that encouraged or aided to do it. And simply is not fair to say that people that can be executed simply by being present because somebody else commits a crime. That's nonsense. It's not true, and it's not accurate, and it's not fair for those that really want to be honest about
this. Is it possible that some prosecutors taint the facts? So
you can only taint it with witnesses' testimony. Now, you may persuade people to claim somebody did something, but that has nothing to do with the law of parties. And the next thing I want to mention, it's always fashionable to say it's a lawyer's fault. Nobody's in prison because of what they did. It's always a lawyer that did it. That's why everybody's in jail. It's not because they did anything wrong, because their lawyer messed it up. And I want to talk about that Bastrop case, as gentlemen talked about. The big problem they got with that is that Reed's DNA matches the DNA of the sperm found in the woman. The only way they could explain that at trial is through consensual sex. And you've got a redneck white girl dating a redneck white cop that they're claiming is having sex with a black guy, and that was never proved at trial. It was out, there were allegations made of that. He claimed that, but nobody believed him. And so, again, like I can say, I'm not against, the most frustrating thing about this is that seems to be no end of lies that people on both sides of this issue will tell or exaggerate. And it doesn't do our cause any good. It makes us look like idiots. We run around and say things about the law of parties being so stupid and evil. It's not stupid and evil. It's a part of every jurisprudence in every state in this union. And it may be abused by people lying about it, but the law of parties makes a lot of good sense. If you do something to aid or encourage somebody to commit a crime, the law says you're as guilty as the person who actually did it. Charlie Manson's a classic example of it.
Well, you know, the people get off. Is it because the stakes are so high that you get this?
I think what it is, Ray, there is, if the biggest, some of the biggest lies, Christianity is one of the biggest lies in the world. I mean, the idea that when you have a fervent belief about something, sometimes we feel as people that we can fudge the truth, we can lie to promote our, because our cause is worthy. Just like the police, and it's the same flip side of what the police say. I've had policemen say to me, "Why are you mad because we beat up some old turd? Why are we mad about that?"
Yeah, why
well, see, it's the same attitude. Why are you mad when we lie to get somebody out of the death penalty? It's the same sort of attitude, and both of them are wrong. And the thing is, I just think it does the death penalty movement a great deal of harm when people, and I'm against the death penalty, don't get me wrong, but I am also really hacked off where it's always the lawyer's fault that someone gets the death penalty. And it's always something, they're harp on the law of parties, which is stupid. It's not, it's a sensible law. And I just think it does makes us look like idiots and does our cause a great deal of harm by exaggerating. We ought to be truthful and honest about it. And the truth of the matter is, a lot of these crimes are so heinous. And the reason, and I'm not saying we're changing some, but here's what we've got now. Now we're giving people life without parole. What's the difference? It's just the form that you die.
Sure, it is.
So this is an improvement.
How long does it take for you to die?
And now this is an improvement. I'm going to kill you by putting you to sleep, or I'll kill you by old age. Killing is killing. And so I don't say that's any great improvement. The reason we're seeking fewer death penalties is because it's more expensive, and number two, we're locking people away, and you see, you can never parole. Now, that's a good system? No. It's just as bad or horrible as a death penalty. And I say, like I say, I get real frustrated with our groups exaggerating.
But what brought you to the conclusion that executions are not a good idea?
Mainly because we can't do it right. We have never, as a group of people, been able to sit down. And I've said this example over and over again. You take the gender difference. If Andrea Yates had been Andy Yates, had a man killed five of his children, they would have executed him. He'd been on death row by now. If a woman did it, it's different. Women are treated differently. Poor people have a lesser chance because they usually have a poorer background, less of a background. I can then get better lawyers. Look at all the lawyers, the Skilling people, all the Enron people. I had great lawyers. All of them are in the penitentiary. Every one of them. It's not so much the lawyer involved. It's the fact that you don't have that lifestyle. Like this poor guy here. If he came from a wealthy family, he could have been treated like the guy that shot Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
you know, same sort of thing. They had the resources to help him out as he's growing up. This guy has no resources. There's a greater probability of getting executed in the Bible Belt than other parts of the country. It just simply isn't a fair way. It's not that people don't commit horrible, heinous acts. Yeah. The question is, as we as society, can we, number one, do it fairly and make sure there's no mistakes, there's no way to correct it once you kill somebody? That's why I'm against it, not because my major reason is that we just have never figured out a way to do it fairly.
How are the other principles of criminal defense and prosecution affected by capital cases? I mean, what they make decisions in capital cases about rules of evidence and all that, doesn't that affect burglary cases?
Sure. And see, this is one of the things that always has annoyed me. Because you never, ever, I don't care what you do, can outlive your past. Because we have things, and to me it's obviously a clear violation of the Constitution to have a habitual criminal statute. A guy goes to jail and serves a term for burglary. He gets out. If he gets in trouble again, his punishment is greater solely because he's an ex-convict. Now, isn't he being punished twice for the same conduct? Isn't that what that amounts to?
Sounds a lot.
Well, of course it is. You take the guy that there was a famous case called Runnels. A guy got an automatic life sentence back when you used to have the old, what we call the big bitch, the little bitch.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
He never stole over $50 in his life. His all misdemeanors bumped up to felonies. And it's a clear violation of the Constitution when you punish people twice for the same conduct, yet we do it. And that record comes back to eat your lunch in death penalty cases, that all that stuff comes in. So, yeah, it has a major impact on it.
And so is there something about, do they treat execution cases in the courtroom environment the same way they treat other cases?
No. There's a lot more pressure. For example, when you have a sensational crime, there's a lot more pressure on the police to solve it. There's a lot more pressure on the police to find somebody to, like, you have a horrible crime, it's a death penalty case, there's a lot more pressure for them to, like the yogurt shop killings in Austin.
Yeah, famous.
Somebody's going to, remember when they,
yeah.
Remember when the little girl up in Conroe, when Brantley got nailed for it? What the ranger said to him, somebody's going to die, and you're the nigger elected to die.
That's right.
It's exactly what he said.
Yeah.
And you have that sort of pressure put upon law enforcement. Then the sad thing is, and there's no way to avoid this, when you have the death penalty, you end up having people promoted in the DA's office because they're ability to get the death sentence. In fact, in New Orleans years ago, they were giving plaques away for guys who got the death penalty. I mean, why not give them a scalp? I mean, it's the same difference.
Right. Some kind of symbol of their victim.
And on the flip side, the way it corrupts on the other side, and when you're the lawyer doing the defense work, I don't care what you do, it's always going to be your fault. If the guy dies, they'll tell any lie in the world, some of these writ people will, to try to get a stay of execution.
Well, they're working for commissary.
Yeah, exactly right. You can be swapped out for a pack of cigarettes.
Absolutely.
Or maybe gum.
Your whole career as an attorney
that's right.
rests on a pack of cigarettes.
Or maybe one.
My friend Jim Skelton, and he and I get in here every time there's an execution and we cut it up. Sometimes it goes better than tonight. Sometimes it goes worse. Frank Moore is our next scheduled execution on January the 21st. He is one of 13 men of the state already scheduled to die during the first 4 months of 2009. Barring a stay, we will have a show. And we may have a show if there is a stay, because there's a lot of unfinished business issues that Jim and I would like to talk about, and we're both kind of anxious to find a little extra time to do that. So one of these shows, nights we could come in here, there's going to be a stay, and we're going to do a show anyway. We come on at 6 p.m. every time there's a scheduled execution. That's Central Time. Next Wednesday is January 21st. Our featured guest will be Scott Cobb, the president of the Texas Moratorium Network. Till then, he encourages listeners to join a special project at amazee.com, abolish the death penalty. So next time you're surfing the web, check out amazee.com/abolish-death-penalty-death-death-penalty. -penalty-. Execution Watch on KPFT Houston's HD2 channel is reached by 90.1 for those of you who have such equipment to do it. We're screaming at executionwatch.org, and you can link that as well from kpft.org or from the logo that says Execution Watch at theprisonshow.org. Spotlighting the badge of shame through the coverage of executions. Tonight, execution of Curtis Moore. Our blog, executionwatch.org/blog. Jim has a new essay up. Check it out, give it a read, and please respond. My name is Ray Hill. This is KPFT Houston.